Final case on our calendar is A23-0685, State of Minnesota versus Christopher Allen Borquist. As you know, you'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument, and appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. The podium is adjustable, and we would appreciate it if you could introduce yourself and the party you represent at the beginning of your argument for purposes of the recording here today.
May please the court, counsel. My name is Charles Clippert, and I'm appearing on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Christopher Allen Borquist. And the issue before the court is a de novo review of a safe harbor provision of a statute that precludes or bars prosecution for someone who seeks medical assistance for an individual who's experiencing a medical issue. And in this case, it was an overdose. And cutting right to the chase, I think the issue before the court is the interpretation of two words in this statute. It's the words, probably three words, good faith and cooperation are what are before the court. But Borquist was out, or the deceased, Mr. Jablonski, was out earlier in the evening with some friends. He was drinking at some bars, and he was openly doing cocaine and offering it to other people. Apparently, he called Borquist, asked for a ride, and Borquist and Jablonski's girlfriend, Ms. Olson, went up to Jablonski's house where they continued to consume alcohol, and they apparently did some cocaine. Mr. Borquist woke up, saw that Jablonski was cold, and called 911. And I think what's important here is he called 911. He tried to do CPR. He let law enforcement in. He helped reposition Mr. Jablonski. He answered the questions that were asked. So it appears that he would qualify for immunity from prosecution.
Well, it seems like the state is saying that good faith requires full cooperation, total honesty in what happens.
Right.
And Borquist did not indicate that the victim, we'll call him, had consumed or taken heroin, almost as if he were hiding the fact that he himself had used heroin. And I think that's where the rub is.
Sure.
So why isn't that doesn't he have an obligation to fully disclose everything that, I mean, isn't that the purpose so they can give the right treatment to the person?
Sure. So that question actually brings up a lot of issues that are here before the case. And one of them is what good faith applies to. And I think when you look at rules of grammar and this court's prior rulings on statutory interpretation, I can't believe I'm going back to my eighth grade English class, but acting in good faith is a prepositional phrase that refers back to the person calling for medical assistance. So that's where the person acting in, the person calling for medical assistance has to be acting in good faith. And
so
that's what that.
Assuming we agree with that, why did the legislature include that requirement, you know, calling in good faith is I think what you're arguing, right?
Right, and I think it's really interesting when you look at the statute to see what is not good faith, because I think that helps to give us an idea of what the legislature meant by that. What is not as good faith is someone calling for medical assistance during the course of an arrest warrant or a search warrant or a lawful search. So I think the idea there is if, you know, say in your small town you get a tip that, or you get an idea that maybe you just sold to a confidential informant, and you're like, oh my gosh, you know, I'm about to get raided. You can't then call and say, hey, my buddy's, you know, having an overdose or having a medical issue. So it would preclude sort of manipulation of the situation to take advantage of this safe harbor provision. But honestly, in my years of doing this, I've never seen that happen. You know, I've never had a case where someone is trying to got a tip off about a search warrant being executed, or that there was a concern about selling to a CI.
But so I think the state is arguing that clause two, you have to do the things in clause two to be acting in good faith.
Right.
But there's sort of a minimum requirements for acting in good faith.
And
why is that not a reasonable reading of the statute?
Well, again, because of the rules of grammar, the rules of statutory interpretation. I also think that the fact that there's a paren one that does not require good faith indicates that the good faith requirement does not apply to the whole statute. But
person qualifies only if, that if they qualify, you know, under one and two, that defines what good faith is? Then by definition, I mean, that's, then you get to claim it? Is that your argument, or just that the phone call itself, or the act of flagging down law enforcement, or whatever the seeking looks like, just that has to be in good faith and nothing else? I'm asking multiple questions.
So sure.
First of all, would it be a reasonable interpretation to say that that first sentence in subdivision one, that sets up the immunity? And then if you can establish one and two, you get that immunity. You don't have to show anything more. You just have to show one and two. You don't have to show any, you know, that you acted in good faith while you were remaining on the scene, or that you acted, that it was good faith cooperation, that it was.
Your Honor, I guess.
And again, I'm just asking
no,
a question, which I think I meant.
I appreciate that, because I think you could look at this and say, good faith is met if you call in with a reasonable belief, the medical issue, and you've got to do these things. But that would be inconsistent with this court's prior rules of statutory interpretation and the rules of grammar.
Which would be?
That the prepositional.
Prepositional phrases.
Right.
Which is school, but I'm
wondering. But Judge, just back, I want to pivot back to your question about the heroin, because this is sort of one of the big gaps in the case. Is Borquist had some heroin in his truck, but there's no evidence that someone went out to his truck and got heroin from his truck. And I think in the respondent's statement of facts, they say that the cocaine they used was from the deceased. So it's really hard for me to. Well, and there's a difference between possession of and use of heroin. And, you know, maybe at that stage of the night they'd had enough and were ready to call it a night and didn't get to the heroin. I mean.
Except that heroin was found in
it. Right.
It was there. We don't know how it got there.
We don't know how it got there. Right. Right. And that's one of the big holes, I think, in this whole case, when you're saying he didn't cooperate because he didn't mention the heroin. Well, the heroin's in the truck. It may not even have been used. And so to say he didn't cooperate because he didn't mention a drug that never was in play that night seems to be kind of a stretch. And I guess.
Well, does the analysis come down to whether the defendant has an ulterior motive for his actions? In other words, if he has an ulterior motive, does that demonstrate bad faith?
And
as opposed to good faith.
Right. And I think, you know, the definition or the idea of good faith is that you are, you know, it's a subjective belief that you are, I think I have a quick little definition here in my notes, but it's a subjective belief that, it's made without an ulterior motive, made without malice, and made for a proper purpose would be a report and made in good faith, and that's that JEB case. So the idea here is is there an ulterior motive? And I guess in my brief, I suggest that if my client wanted to avoid prosecution, there were hundreds of things he could have done differently, including letting, you know, the deceased die on his own. And that obviously would frustrate the purpose of the statute.
So just so I'm clear on your argument, are you arguing, I think you're arguing that the district court imposed, read the requirement to cooperate with authorities as cooperating in good faith with authorities.
Correct.
And you're arguing that that was an error of law.
Yes.
If the district court erred in that way and should have just considered whether the call was made in good faith and then considered whether he, appellant, cooperated, why aren't the district court's fact findings about cooperation sufficient, you know, to for this court to analyze it? Or is there a need for the district court to do additional fact finding with on whether defendant cooperated using the correct legal standard, which in your view, you know, in your view, the correct legal standard doesn't require cooperating in good faith. So is there a need for a remand for fact-finding on whether he cooperated? Because you're reading the district court's order as making findings of fact as to whether he cooperated in good faith, but maybe it's a different question as to whether or not he simply cooperated.
Right, right. And I think the district court's order is really clear that the district court implied or required good faith to be applied throughout the whole statute. And I think when you look at the...
So I guess what I'm asking is do you agree that whether he cooperated is a fact question?
Yes.
And if so, then do we need to remand back to the district court to make findings of fact as to whether or not he cooperated in terms of whether this defense applies or not?
Yes. And I think what you need to do is you look at the... Since cooperated is not defined in the statute, it's, you know, did he...
Or not defense, immunity. Sorry.
Yeah, the immunity. No, I'm sorry.
I shouldn't have said defense because I don't think it is a defense. I think it's an immunity.
Yes. But, you know, and you look back to the definition of cooperate, to work together for a particular purpose or to be helpful by doing what someone asked you to do. And I think that second definition, I think, is particularly important here because law enforcement shows up on the scene. My client's not driving the bus at that stage. Law enforcement is... They're taking over the scene to try and figure out what's going on. And he's cooperating. He's doing what law enforcement is asking him to do. And
but it's not our role to make findings of fact.
Right.
So.
Right. I guess my concern is this definition of cooperation can't be fluid because the Stearns County Attorney's Office seems to say that cooperation... This is in their brief, requires the person seeking medical assistance to be fully forthcoming and act with a shared goal of or reversing the overdose. That's rewriting the statute. That's not in the statute. And so the Stearns County Attorney's Office may have one definition of cooperation, and the Redwood County's Attorney's Office may have another definition. So I think you need to look at the definition that's provided, you know, in our commonly understood meaning to see whether my client did cooperate, and obviously I'm up here arguing he did. So I think a remand to the district court to see whether, to review the findings of fact would be appropriate here.
What findings? I mean, is it a legal conclusion whether somebody cooperated? Like I'm making these, this is what Borgquist did when, you know, made the call, et cetera, et cetera. But then whether he satisfied the obligation to cooperate, is that a factual question for which would be a district court, or is that a question, a legal question then? Given these facts of what happened, does that...
I think it would be similar to like a contested omnibus hearing issue where it would be a mixed question of facts and law. The district court would have to make the appropriate findings of facts and then apply the law to those facts. So I think that would be appropriate to do.
So what are the outer limits, if we're trying to figure out what does cooperate mean, and given the intent of the statute to save lives, I mean, why is the district court's interpretation incorrect? Because the more information you provide, you know, he knew there were these, you know, he'd texted back and forth about Brown, which law enforcement said meant heroin. So why, you know, why was that incorrect?
Because again, when the law enforcement asked what happened last night, so, you know, Borgquist is, you know, waking up, his friend is dying, he's probably not in the best state of mind, and he gives a summary of what happened. It's only when law enforcement asks these further clarifying questions, he answers honestly or answers the question. So he's cooperating. He's providing the law enforcement with the information they're asking for. So I think that's why
is he... There a do we have to look at the context then in which it, you know, like how intoxicated the person might have been when they the caller was, or, I mean, is there...
I think there is a, you have to look at a little bit of the context of each situation, because it's not a, I can't imagine there's going to be the same set of facts or same set of circumstances in every application of this statute. So I think context is important. I see my time is over, so I just ask the court to.
There's one more question from the panel, and then you'll
have
rebuttal.
For a remand to, for what?
Yes, Your Honor, I'm asking, I think it's appropriate for this court to remand for the district court to consider an appropriate standard of good faith and cooperation.
And that would be for the purpose of having the affirmative defense allowed at a trial?
If the court does not allow the immunity, then I think the case should go forward with allowing the defense to present a the safe harbor provision. Thank you.
Good morning. The podium's adjustable if you want to put it down a little.
May it please the court, my name is George Kennedy. I'm an assistant Sherburne County attorney, and I appear on behalf of respondent, the state of Minnesota. We're asking the court to affirm in this case, based on the facts here, Mr. Borgquist is not entitled to immunity under the good faith or the Good Samaritan overdose statute. Specifically, looking at his conduct and the definition of good faith that he is now adopted from JEB, there is a mental state that's required and also certain actions that a person has to comply with. And here, his actions show that he did not have that requisite mental state. First of all, when he was speaking with law enforcement, he only described...
So let's turn to the statute, though, because it sounds like you're arguing that good faith applies to cooperating with authorities.
That's correct.
And how does the language of the statute support that interpretation where the good faith is found in the first sentence and then there's a completely different sentence much later in the subdivision that talks about who qualifies, that you qualify only if one and two, but and then it, so it doesn't reference good faith in the next sentence.
That's true, but the statute talks about a person acting in good faith, and acting is a progressive tense of the word act, so that means that it's a continuing or ongoing responsibility. You have to continue acting in good faith throughout this entire incident instead of just up until the moment of making that phone call. Because if the legislature had wanted to limit it to that, they would have used different language. They would have said a person who seeks medical assistance in good faith and then continued. By using acting, it's an ongoing requirement to do those things. Because otherwise, the requirements in provision 2, parent 2, kind of lose any meaning. It says you have to provide a name and contact information. If you're not required to act in good faith during that period, I could say that I am Charles Clippert.
But that would be illogical. But it goes on to say that the person just has to remain on the scene until assistance arrives or is provided. So if Mr. Borquist had just left once the, let's assume he stayed through the sheriff's deputy and then he just left when the firefighters arrived, he wouldn't have to answer any questions, and that's okay under the statute, or is it not?
I don't think that's okay because he has to cooperate with the authorities in addition to remaining on scene until the assistance arrives.
So if we parse the word cooperate so closely, doesn't that defeat the purpose of the statute? Because the purpose of the statute is to place saving lives in instances of drug overdose over criminal prosecution. And the whole point is you want people who don't want to contact law enforcement because they've probably done something unlawful, presumably maybe illegal drugs, maybe something else. So if we had too many limitations on it, aren't we defeating the whole purpose of the statute, which is to encourage people who are not in, if I'm acting completely lawfully, I don't need this statute. I see somebody in distress, I will call 911. The point is to encourage people who are doing something, on the wrong side of the law, to encourage them to call 911. So how do we come to your interpretation, given that the ultimate purpose of statutory interpretation is the intent, to implement the intent of the legislature.
Well, and I think that that's where in this case, Mr. Borquist knew that heroin was a possibility. There'd been discussions of it. There'd been indications that the victim was interested in using heroin. Mr. Borquist said, I've got heroin. There was, in fact, heroin in his possession. And given all of that information, cooperation required letting law enforcement know, here are the possibilities. And all he did was say, here are all the things that the victim was responsible for bringing to the situation. I am hiding everything that I did to make a bad situation worse.
But it seems a little bit inconsistent because he said there was cocaine used, right?
Correct.
So, he's already admitting that there's a criminal act going on.
Correct.
So how do we know if he even is thinking about heroin, at the time? That seems like a far stretch to impute that onto somebody in an emergency situation to think of every conceivable thing that the person might have used and to require that they make a full disclosure of every single thing like marijuana. And what if he hadn't said anything about the marijuana? Is that enough to take away the application of the statute?
I'm not familiar with anyone dying from a marijuana overdose.
Well, but still, that's full cooperation.
True. But we're dealing with a situation where law enforcement was responding to an overdose, and they needed information about what could have caused that overdose.
How do we know that, at the time, is it clear that it was an overdose at the time he called? There was vomit, but There was also alcohol involved.
Which would also have been a possible overdose situation if it was alcohol related.
So but you were referring to the drugs, so okay.
Yep.
Well, I guess I have a related question. What, in your view, what does the word cooperate mean for purposes of this statute?
In the context of this statute, cooperate means working together towards a shared goal of saving the person's life. And that requires providing the relevant information available to you so that the people, the first responders, can properly address the medical situation. And here you had signs that it was an overdose. Mr. Borgquist knew of the cocaine use, knew that there was alcohol use, knew that there was an interest in heroin, and heroin had in fact been present because he brought it, but there was never information given to law enforcement that would have triggered for them the response of, I need to try Narcan to see if that reverses
the
medical incident.
I mean, the narrative that Mr. Borgquist provided as he picked the deceased person up at 1 or 1:30 in the morning. So nobody knows what he did before. So an EMT would go, okay, we know he's done cocaine, we know he's done, you know, junk alcohol. Nobody here knows what he did before 1 or 1:30. So you know, tying it into the Narcan, and if only he'd said that, and that would have made a difference. I mean, I understand the argument, but, like, I don't know if there's a question in there.
How do we know the cause of death? Was it the heroin that caused the death, or was it a combination of things? Do we know?
Toxic effects of fentanyl, heroin, cocaine, and I believe alcohol.
Could have killed them.
I think it was described as a combination of them.
Okay, would he have died anyway if he hadn't had the heroin?
I don't know if that was included in the...
No.
I'm not sure, Your Honor.
So how can we say that that lack of cooperation caused his death? I mean, what percentage of cooperation do you need? Do you need 75%, 98%, 99%, or 100%? What's the formula?
I want to be clear that I'm not tying cooperation to saving a person's life.
Okay. Well, let's tie it to a percentage of cooperation. How much cooperation do you need? Is it absolutely 100%? Is 99% enough?
If you are going to work with law enforcement and your purpose in this action is saving that person's life with them, I think you need to provide 100% of the relevant information that you know about this.
How do we determine what 100% is? Or is that a jury question?
I don't think that that would be a jury question, Your Honor, because this is an immunity statute. It would be the way that it was presented here was as a probable cause challenge, saying that because of this statute, I am not able to be prosecuted. We do not think that this is an affirmative defense that should be presented at trial, because it's enumerated as an immunity statute, and it also operates as a suppression rule. It talks about...
But isn't cooperation a fact question, not a legal question?
It's a fact question that goes to a suppression ruling. So it says, the statute says, if you qualify for immunity in this incident, the evidence that was obtained during the response is not admissible against you. If law enforcement has an alternative, independent way of presenting this case, the case can go forward. So really, this is use and derivative use immunity. It provides a suppression rule for the court to apply after an omnibus hearing.
Either one way or the other in this case, right? I mean, either he wins or loses on the immunity issue.
Well, as
And if the immunity statute applies, then he can't be prosecuted. If it does, then he could be prosecuted for possession of heroin, right?
It's an immunity statute, so if the court decides that the district court erred in its legal analysis and the way that it applied the legal standard, but the court's ruling provides some guidance on what cooperation or good faith means, I think that there are some grounds for a remand there for that omnibus issue to be readdressed if the court decides that his conduct did not qualify for immunity, then the conviction should be affirmed.
Do you think the statute is ambiguous, subdivision one?
I do not.
So you don't think that appellant's reading is a reasonable reading given the placement of good faith in reading it as a prepositional phrase?
Again, I don't think so because the way that I was taught a preposition is that it's any way that a mouse can run. And I don't know how a mouse can run acting in good faith or what that means grammatically. So when I read that statute, it's a present it's a progressive tense verb saying that this good faith standard applies throughout your conduct. It's not something that stops. It's an ongoing obligation. And that's why it doesn't just begin and end with the seeking of medical assistance. It continues through the entire time that law enforcement or first responders are dealing with this medical incident. And as the court was discussing earlier, that we read provision two as essentially a definition of the complete requirement for seeking medical assistance. It's not just making a phone call or flagging down an EMT. It's staying on scene, providing information about yourself, and cooperating with law enforcement, which in this case means saying, I know that we used cocaine, I know that we used alcohol last night. He was also interested in heroin.
So it's in subdivision one, the second, where the cooperates appears.
Yes.
It says remains on the scene until assistance arrives or is provided. Is that a disjunctive or is that an or where we can read it, where we should read it as and is provided? Sorry, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I think it helps put cooperate into some kind of context.
I think that it has to be read as conjunctive, because if you leave as soon as assistance arrives, then you aren't, it takes the meaning away from cooperates with authorities. You aren't doing anything to help other than the other requirements in the statutes. That language that cooperates with the authorities would essentially become surplusage if all you have to do is stay there until somebody else arrives. So I think that it has to be arrives and then a conjunctive or is provided, and then you also have to cooperate with authorities once that assistance has arrived and started providing the medical assistance. If there are no other questions, we ask the court to affirm.
Okay, thank you.
I think there's just two points I just want to address. One is your concern about the public policy issue here, and I think that's very important because if we start reading into this statute very technical requirements about cooperation, that is going to have, it's going to push people away from seeking help. And I think if the overall policy is to have people call when there's an emergency and not fear prosecution, if you go to a Narcan training and they say, well, you know, this Borgquist case came out and it says that you've got to cooperate, which means you've got to, the minute the cops open the door, you've got to make a full-throated confession, people are going to go, hey, I'm not, that's a little heavy for me. I may not do that. And so I think this statute's got to be interpreted, again, consistent with the legislative policy of encouraging people to call. And we got a little bit into the legislative history on this, but based on the respondent's brief, I re-reviewed the testimony and the closing statement of Senator Eaton, and at 2 hours, 53 minutes, and 6 seconds in, she says, if nobody calls, nobody gets arrested anyway. If someone dies and there's no one there, there's no one to arrest. If people hang around and they could possibly give information to law enforcement, there is a benefit to that.
And so I think, same question that Judge Cochran asked the state. Is this statute ambiguous or not?
Probably doesn't rise to the level of ambiguous, maybe inartfully drafted. I wish they had said cooperated with law enforcement by doing whatever they were going to do. But I think if we look at the common everyday usage of cooperate, I don't think it gets too ambiguous. I would have asked for better clarity, but this is what we're dealing with. And then, Judge, your point about cooperation, I think, is really important as well, because say if someone does 2 lines of coke, or says we did 2 lines of coke and they really did 3, is that not cooperating? Is that the sort of the situation we want to get into? It's interesting that fentanyl is found in this, in the deceased, because there's no mention of fentanyl anywhere. Fentanyl's everywhere. I mean, drugs are cut with fentanyl all over the place. I have a case where some people, it's a federal case where people thought they were doing coke, they did fentanyl, and 2 people overdosed. So is there no cooperation here because no one mentioned fentanyl? I think that's getting to be a really difficult situation, or a very trying situation. Or if the defendant or the person calling 911 says the car was gray and it was really blue, is that not cooperating? I think it needs to be, cooperation needs to be read, I guess, in terms of that generally accepted term. And I think Borgquist cooperated. He told the cops, he answered the law enforcement questions when asked. And when directly asked about drugs, he answered.
I'm curious about how this looks, if it should be remanded, how it looks. You're arguing for a remand. And Mr. Kennedy said that it would go back and... So what do you argue on remand then? Mm-hmm. I mean, is it... Does the district court look at it again and say, well, or I'm just trying to figure this out, how it looks on remand.
And I guess the court could, in theory, because I think the record is fairly robust, I think the court could look at the record that was provided at the omnibus hearing, because I think body-worn camera was provided, police reports were provided, and say, based on the record here and how we interpret cooperate in good faith, I think the court could say, yeah, the immunity statute applies and dismiss the charges.
But the district court has already said that you didn't cooperate.
Right.
So.
And you're not a fact finding.
Right.
Right.
So if that's already the finding, then why would we remand it?
Because I think you could remand for fact finding consistent with what I'm asking the court to find good faith and what I'm asking the court to find cooperation, which is a broader. Which, because the district court required good faith throughout the whole process and found that my client did not act in good faith by not immediately confessing to heroin use, which there's no evidence there was heroin use. So I think that could be dealt with on remand.
But so can I ask another question?
Sure.
So the district court made findings of fact, and then there were conclusions based on those findings. You're not challenging any of the actual findings of fact. How she interpreted or applied that, correct, the district court?
I question one finding of fact, and
okay.
I sort of alluded to it here, where she says it was more likely than not that heroin, that my client provided heroin. But
okay, all right.
I think there's no evidence of that.
So that she couldn't make the inference based on the presence of heroin in his car and the text messages?
I think that's a stretch because, you know, there's no evidence that someone went out to the car, got the bottle, brought heroin in, or somehow.
But that was the heroin in. There's not enough evidence,
yes.
You're saying, that was the heroin that was found in his body.
Yes.
Okay.
So thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thanks to both counsel for your helpful arguments today. The matter is submitted, and we will issue our opinion within the statutory time frame. That concludes our calendar for today. We are now in recess.
All right.